Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Kerry Curtis, chair of the club's Environment and Natural Resources member-led forum and your chair for today. We also welcome our listening audience and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker for the evening. Her name is Amy Gulick. She's an American nature and wildlife photographer who is one of the founding fellows of the International League of Conservation Photographers. Her award-winning images have been featured in many magazines, including publications of the National Audubon Society, the National Wildlife Federation, the National Parks Conservation Association, and the Sierra Club, as well as Nature's Best Photography magazine. In 2001, she published an internet journal about her three-week photography expedition to the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. This effort won a Lowell Thomas Travel Journalism Award presented by the Society of American Travel Writers Foundation in 2002. She has also received the Daniel Hausberg Wilderness Image Award from the Alaska Conservation Foundation and was awarded a Philip Hyde Grant from the North American Nature Photography Association. In 2010, she published Salmon in the Trees, Life in Alaska's Tongass Rainforest, a book containing her photographs and along with stories from people who live in that area. The book has been called A Great Achievement in Environmental Photography and Ecology. The book is for sale, as I told you. Amy has a degree from Purdue University's Krannert School of Management, where I understand they do not have a major in photography. No, they don't. Amy joins us this evening to talk about her book and about her experiences in Alaska. Join me in welcoming Amy. Try that one. He turned it on.
Thank you very much. I love being in San Francisco. I'm from Seattle, and so it's always really nice to come down here and visit and see the sun. And today was a very glorious day to do that. So I'd like to thank the Commonwealth Club, Kerry Curtis, the organizer, and also like to thank Earth Justice, particularly Bill Karpowitz in the back there, for making it possible for me to be here tonight. And a big thank you to all of you for being here, taking time out of your busy lives and fighting traffic or whatever you need to do to get here. It's very much appreciated. So I'm often asked, what are the hazards of being a nature photographer, particularly one who spends a lot of time in wilderness areas like I do? Is it negotiating a class 4 river? Is it traveling in bear country? Or is it flying in a bush plane with the door off? Well, while all these things are potentially hazardous, I'd have to say that they somewhat pale in comparison to something else, and that would be curiosity. To do what I do, make pictures that tell stories, you have to have a healthy amount of curiosity for the often long time it can take to pursue telling these stories. So why would this be hazardous? Well, you've probably all heard the phrase, curiosity killed the cat. And while my curiosity, as far as I know, hasn't actually killed anyone, those who know me well, particularly my husband, will attest that I often drive people mad with my endless questions of why things are the way they are. Those of you with small children, you know exactly what I'm talking about. And I just really never outgrew that phase, I guess you'd call it. So questions like, why is the sky blue? Why are no two snowflakes ever the same? And why are there salmon in trees? It is this last question that I've spent the last several years of my life pursuing. And while no one was killed or injured in the making of this story, the journey became somewhat of an obsession for me, but fueled by curiosity. So if curiosity killed the cat, then satisfaction brought it back. And I'm honored to be here tonight to tell you the story that I brought back pursuing my adventures with salmon in the trees. I'm more than happy to answer any questions, but if we could wait until the end, that would be great. So if we could get the lights. I'm going to kill this one over here. So, where to begin this crazy quest for salmon in trees? And all the illustrations that you'll see here tonight that are kind of intermingled with the photographs, these are by beloved Alaskan artist Ray Troll. And some of you may be familiar with his work. If you're not, he's just an incredible, very wacky, fish-oriented artist. So before leaving home, a friend gave me some sound advice. He said, "Remember, Amy, a journey of 1,000 miles can end in failure." Yeah, good confidence builder there. So at the start, all I knew was that I needed to go to Alaska. But Alaska is so mind-boggling in its size, it would be like saying I needed to go to Africa. Alaska is by far our largest state. It's more than twice the size of Texas, the second largest state. And most of us still tend to think that all of Alaska is this vast frozen expanse with roaming polar bears. And if there are any people at all, they must live in igloos and travel by dog sled. And, well, that's a somewhat accurate description of some parts of Alaska. Where I needed to go is not what comes to mind when we think of our 49th state. I was going to the rainforest of Alaska. Now, I don't know about you, but I always thought that rainforests were in Brazil and Indonesia, warm places near the equator with parrots, primates, and pythons. Well, those are tropical rainforests, also called jungles. And the rainforest of Alaska is what's called a coastal temperate rainforest. And this is one of the rarest ecosystems on the planet. Now, most of Alaska's rainforest is in what's called Southeast Alaska. This is also known as the panhandle of the state and more commonly or more famously known as part of the Inside Passage for anyone cruising all those sheltered waterways among thousands of islands. Now, almost 80% of Southeast Alaska is the Tongass National Forest. So anywhere we see in green, that's the Tongass National Forest. The Tongass is a place where the forest meets the sea. Clouds slam up against this jagged coast range that separates Alaska and British Columbia on the mainland, and this creates rain. This creates lots of rain. More than 200 inches a year in some places nourish this coastal forest. I quickly learned why rubber boots are an essential part of every Southeast Alaskan's wardrobe. They wear these to weddings. They wear these to the symphony. I'm pretty sure they wear them to bed. My favorite is when, on one of the rare sunny, dry days up there, warm, you'll see somebody on a bicycle, T-shirt, shorts, fishing pole over their shoulder, and rubber boots on. And you think, well, that's an interesting look. But you quickly understand why. The second you get off pavement or a boardwalk, any kind of hard surface, that ground is wet. It never dries out up there. Now, much of the Tongass is spread out over 5,000 islands in what's called the Alexander Archipelago. And because of this, no point on land is very far from the sea. And so at times, this line is blurred between where the forest ends and the sea begins. So you'll see things here, like bears digging for clams on the beaches. I had no idea that bears ate clams until coming here. Marbled murrelets, this is a seabird that nests high in the trees and feeds in the ocean. Humpback whales cruise right along the forested shorelines. And this is always my favorite. You're in the forest now, you're hiking along, kind of trudging through all this greenery. No thought in the world of the ocean, and there at your feet is something like this. So barnacle-encrusted mussel shells, you'll see clam shells, you'll see crab parts, fish parts, all kinds of things dragged in from the beaches into the forest by animals like ravens or river otters. At 17 million acres, this is about the size of the state of West Virginia, the Tongass is by far our country's largest national forest. This is something I can relate to, being from Seattle. About 70,000 people live in this part of Alaska, but because of all the islands and the rugged mountains, the most reliable modes of transportation here are definitely not automobiles. There are roads, but they really don't go anywhere, and they don't connect anything. So the most reliable modes of transportation here are boats. This is the Alaska State Ferry. And seaplanes act as taxis. So while I had narrowed my search for salmon in the trees to a relatively small portion of Alaska, it would still take a lifetime to explore all of the Tongass. So where to start and how to get around in this land of islands and jagged peaks? Well, I decided to do something that I really didn't want to do. And that was fly in a small plane with the door off. This is definitely a potential hazard. And don't let that smile fool you. It is one of madness and not joy. But the pilot assured me that I would be strapped in with fail-safe buckles and a strong barrier across the opening. Well, I showed up, and one 1970s-style station wagon frayed lap belt, one very skimpy piece of tape over the buckle. It wasn't even duct tape. It was electrical tape. And one very worn clothesline. It was more like a piece of twine over that opening. And against my better judgment, I was in the air. Now, I thought if I closed my eyes, then maybe it wouldn't be so bad. But that would defeat the whole purpose. It only took a few minutes, though, for my fear to somewhat disappear as the beauty below me took my breath away. Or maybe it was that cinched seatbelt strangling my circulation. So I did this because I wanted to get a big picture view of this immense region. And from the air, it's easy to see that the Tongass is a giant mosaic of very different landscapes. While the Tongass is a national forest, only about 60% is actually forested. The rest is rock, ice, wetlands, and more than 20,000 lakes and ponds and 40,000 miles of streams. And during the last ice age, parts of southeast Alaska were covered in ice, and glaciers have played a large role in sculpting the Tongass into what we see today. So all of the straits and inlets of the Inside Passage of southeast Alaska are glacial fjords, gouged by the Pleistocene glaciers, which bore deep into the bedrock well below sea level. And when the glaciers receded, salt water then flooded these valleys. Tidewater glaciers, these are where the ice and the sea actually meet. These are found in three areas of southeast Alaska. One is more famously known as Glacier Bay National Park, and the other two are in the Tongass National Forest. Again, this is not really what we think of when we hear the words national forest. So from the air, you get this big glacial picture of the region, but nothing will help you understand the forces of glaciers more than actually being on one. And even better, if you can swing it, is being under one. It is here where the glacier seems most alive, where rock and ice duke it out. And through sheer weight, the ice bears down and the rock succumbs. But long after the glaciers retreat, the rock bounces back. The land in southeast Alaska, it's been freed from this enormous weight of ice, and it's uplifted in a process called isostatic rebound. And in places, the land has risen hundreds of feet, and it's still rising today in this geologically active part of the world. So this gives new meaning to the term waterfront property. If you have waterfront property, you might find yourself with more, and that is actually happening. So what do glaciers have to do with salmon and trees? Well, when the glaciers retreated, some new occupants moved in. Things like seeds, spores, bugs, shrubs, birds, beavers, trees, deer, wolves, fish, bears, and people. And the forest was born. So in 1916, almost 100 years ago, the glacier that you just saw used to be right there where that rock is. So you can kind of get a sense of that there has been a forest that has grown in since it's receded. And it is in the forest where I will find trees and perhaps salmon in the trees. And besides, I will be safely back on the ground and out of that airplane. Although safe is a relative term here. One of the world's highest densities of brown bears, also known as grizzly bears, lives here, as well as the highest density of black bears in the world. And the forests are quite thick. So it's not like you can see a bear coming a mile away. Sometimes you can't even see a bear coming a few footsteps away. So surely if I stayed back out on the water, I'd be okay, right? Well, bears can swim. And the sea is loaded with large creatures with big teeth as well. At certain times of the year, it's hard to look anywhere on or under the water and not see something stunning. Dahl's porpoises, clocked at speeds of 30 knots, may be the fastest of all the small cetaceans. When I plunged into the icy waters here, again against my better judgment, I was astounded at all of the colorful life. This is a China rockfish amidst cold water Gorgonian corals. Who knew that there were corals in this part of the world in 42-degree water? And rockfish are fascinating. There's many different species of rockfish, and many of them live upwards of 100, 125 years. This is a sea anemone. Parts of the area here are just plastered with these, all different shapes, sizes, and colors. You would think that you're in the tropics, seeing these kinds of colors. These are what are called nudibranchs, known as the slugs of the sea, and arguably more beautiful than the slugs of the land. But when I was underwater, it was these big guys, the stellar sea lions, that would buzz me any chance that they could. And you have no idea just how fast and how powerful they are until you find yourself face to face with one or 10, because they seem to roam around in large gangs. There's never just one. For sheer size, though, nothing beats the humpback whale. Now, humpbacks migrate to this area every spring, traveling thousands of miles from their birthing grounds in places like Hawaii to dine on the smorgasbord of herring and small shrimp called krill. Sometimes the whales employ a technique called bubble net feeding, and this is where they spiral upward and they blow a curtain of bubbles that confuses and corrals their prey. They then burst through the surface and scoop up the lassoed rewards. Now, there's nothing quite as thrilling as being in the middle of a pod of humpback whales. But if you're in a hurry to get somewhere, they can be quite annoying, as they will disrupt your schedule. So you're on a boat, and you're trying to get from point A to point B, and you've got the currents to deal with, and weather, and numbers of different factors, and suddenly off in the distance you see, this spout, from the whales, and like, oh, so you motor over there, and you always think it's much closer than it is. It takes you about an hour to get over there, and then an hour's gone by, and then you're watching them, and then you have to photograph them, and then, pretty soon you're just hours, days gone, complete, just poof. while I will admit that they sucked hours and days away from my search for salmon in the trees, they were a very welcome distraction. So do I travel here by land or by sea? Well, both. It's how the native people lived for thousands of years, and today people's lives here are very much tied to both. I learned quickly how to tell time by the tides, and you don't go anywhere here without a tide table in your back pocket. Now, the Tongass is traditionally Tlingit Indian territory, and in more recent times, it's home to some Haida and Tsimshian people as well. And all native peoples of the area traditionally located their villages just above high tide line. And the tidal exchanges in this part of the world are huge, more than 20 feet in places, and with clams, seaweed, gumboot chitons, and other food sources right out their front door. The native folks have a saying that very much holds true today. When the tide is out, the table is set. And very true. When I would go into very traditional native villages, if it was extreme low tides, you wouldn't find anybody inside. They were all out gathering food. So since time immemorial, the sea's been a very important food source for the first peoples of the Tongass, and very much continues to be so today. These are two young men in the village of Cake, filleting a halibut that will then get distributed to all community members. And other village members in Cake, all different ages here, they're preparing smoked salmon in the background. This is smoked seal meat and braided and smoked seal intestine. And while that may not sound particularly appetizing to us, the kids absolutely love it. It's very chewy, and I think it's kind of their version of gum. The forest is important, too, for things like berries and medicinal and ceremonial plants, and trees for totem poles, longhouses, and weaving materials. It's no surprise that the artworks, dances, and oral histories of the native folks in the Tongass region are rich with stories of people and creatures like salmon, bears, and whales transforming into one another. Clans like killer whale, frog, and wolf speak to the importance of both land and sea. So in the native cultures here, family lines follow the mother, and people belong to one of two major groups known as moieties. So in this part of the world, you are either an eagle or you are a raven. So I had the honor of spending time with many native people who allowed me a glimpse into their culture. In the village of Kluwak on Prince of Wales Island, I spent time in John Rowan Jr.'s carving shed. John is a Tlingit Eagle of the Shankwaidi Wolf Clan. He's also a United States Marine and a native arts teacher, instructing students in subjects like carving, language, oral history, and dancing. And in addition to teaching the next generation of kids, John is carving the third generation of totem poles for his village. This is an enormous undertaking. It's 21 poles in all, with at least 250 hours going into each one, and it's taken him 10 years to do this. Carving next to him is 15-year-old Noelle Demert. She's a Tlingit Eagle of the Kagwantan clan, and she's the lead carver on this totem pole to honor a Haida man who carved and gifted a canoe to the people of her village. And John told me that not too long ago, the native people were just barely hanging on to their culture by their fingernails. Nobody was carving. No one was making those beautiful spruce and cedar hats or the button blanket robes. He says today, though, that there's been a resurgence, and he hopes that the youth grab hold and run with it. I was very honored to attend the pole-raising ceremony for the pole that Noelle carved under John's watchful eye. This is an occasion of great celebration, where the people dress in their clan regalia and perform traditional dances and songs. If you ever get the opportunity to attend a pole-raising ceremony, I encourage you to go. It's a very powerful event. So this is Noelle, the young woman that you saw earlier carving, and this is John proudly looking on. And no celebration like this would be complete without a feast, including salmon, one of the most important food sources for the native cultures and a very important part of the economy for many people in Southeast Alaska. So, oh yeah, salmon in trees, the focus of my quest. You can see how easy it is to get distracted here, particularly as a photographer. There are just interesting subjects everywhere you turn. So where there are salmon fishermen, there must be salmon. And so I hook up with Carl Jordan. He's a fourth-generation Alaskan salmon fisherman out of Sitka on Baranof Island. And Carl's proud to catch what he considers the best food in the world. At 28 years old, he's more in tune with his connection to the natural world than most people twice his age. His commute aboard his 38-foot trolling boat takes him past forested islands and breaching whales. He looks for seabirds feeding on herring. This is a good sign that salmon may be present. Weather, tides, and water temperatures guide his decisions, and he knows he's part of an intricate web. And Carl is typical of many fishermen in the Tongass region, and I think for those of us who aren't familiar with commercial fishing, particularly in Alaska, it's done very well up there. We're very surprised to learn that it's small mom-and-pop operators like him that are delivering the best food in the world to our grocery stores and our restaurants. This is Carl's young family, and they also double as his crew. So everybody's helping and cleaning the boat here. And so Carl tells me he's thankful for the salmon because they do us an awesome service by nourishing our bodies. And then he says something that makes my head spin. He says that when the salmon swim into the forest, they nourish the trees, too. Could this be salmon in the trees? I promptly thank him, jump off the boat, and head back to land. So I needed to find salmon in the forest, and I asked the wildlife biologist where to go, and he said, any stream. Now, given that I didn't have an entire lifetime to explore the 40,000 miles of streams in the Tongass, I asked if he could be a little bit more specific. He repeated, as if I were a stubborn child who was pestering him with a silly, curious question, any stream. Well, he was right. So when you go looking for salmon in streams, you will almost certainly see bears as well, whether you want to or not. And on Admiralty Island, it'd be highly unusual not to see bears, and that's where I was headed. The Tlingit people call this island Kootsnuwu, which translates into Fortress of the Bears. Now, it's an appropriate name, as Admiralty has one of the highest densities of brown bears in the world, an average of nearly one bear per square mile. So think of, you know, every time, say, in the city, if you saw a McDonald's or a Starbucks or a Pete's, just replace that with a bear. That's how many there are on this island. It's pretty incredible. So islands worldwide, think of the Galapagos or Hawaii. These are living laboratories for studying the effects that islands have on the distribution of animals and plants. And the islands of the Tongass are no exception. The mix of wildlife on any island, it's a combination of things like time, chance, mobility, predation, and resistance to drowning. So in the Tongass, if you don't want to see brown bears, then there are three islands that you should not visit. Admiralty, Baranof, and Chichagof, and these are known as the ABC Islands. Now, there are no black bears on these three islands, although black bears are plentiful on other islands, and both brown and black bears live on the mainland. And scientists studying the brown bears on these ABC islands theorize that they are descendants of a long isolated group. And believe it or not, they're more closely related to polar bears than they are to the brown bears on the mainland. And this research supports the idea that there were pockets of land called refugia that were not entirely covered by ice during the last ice age. Now, it's fascinating to contemplate the past, but the second you step foot on Admiralty Island, all that matters is the present. There's nothing like being in a place known as the Fortress of the Bears to make you acutely aware of the here and now. You're in someone else's home. This is what's left of one of the trailhead signs after the bears got done chewing it to pieces. So you're in someone else's home, someone a lot bigger and stronger than you, and be nice to return to your own home at some point. So you're on your very best behavior. It's as if Miss Manners or the Queen of England herself greeted you at the shores of the island. So you announce yourself. You're considerate. You're super clean with food. You give your host, particularly the lady of the house and her offspring, plenty of personal space. Now, if you do all of these things, you'll likely have a pleasant visit, perhaps extraordinary. So the mouth of Pat Creek on Admiralty Island, this is a beautiful example of a rich estuary. This is a place where freshwater streams empty into the bays of the coastline. And an estuary is in a constant state of flux as the tides ebb and flow. Fine sediments are pushed into the intertidal area and support the growth of salt-tolerant plants. Biologically, estuaries are highly productive areas, supporting a rich mix of both terrestrial and marine life. Nutritious sedges, like you see here, grow in estuaries, and they nourish many different animals. I had no idea just how much salad bears will eat until I watched them grazing on sedges day after day. And so when I visited Admiralty Island in early August, salmon were leaving the ocean, and they were entering this estuary. And sure enough, there were plenty of bears waiting for them. Now, there is nothing like watching bears in their home. And at Pat Creek, there are no fences, there's no guard dogs keeping watch over us. The only thing that separates us here is respect. And that's really respect on our part. So when you arrive on Admiralty Island, either by boat or float plane, because that's the only way to get there, you land over here somewhere, and you walk out on this little spit and into that little trail, and right there in that little spot, you sit, and then hopefully the bears are coming in and they're feeding on the salmon. And right there, those two little brown dots, those are bears. So this is the on-the-ground version of that viewing area I just showed you. Again, there's no fences. There's absolutely nothing separating us here. But it seemed like, for the most part, as long as we stayed in our space and our behavior was somewhat predictable to the bears, they seemed to just go about their day. But every now and then, a younger bear would get chased into our space by a dominant bear. I mean, literally just run, you know, couple feet away from us, or a bear just gets curious, I think, as to maybe what we are and, you know, what we're doing up there. These are the encounters you don't ever forget, and you don't ever forget who is in charge. One evening, our commute back to our camp was delayed for about an hour or so until this bear wandered away from our vehicle. So I'm watching the bears here because the salmon are here, but why are the salmon here? Well, salmon are remarkable creatures. They're born in freshwater streams and rivers. They head out to the oceans to mature, and then they return to their birth streams as adults to spawn the next generation. Now, think about that for a minute. The salmon are out there in the ocean, thousands of miles away from where they were born, and somehow, at just the right time, they find their way back to the very place where they started their lives. That has to be one of the greatest feats of nature. The Tonga supports all five species of Pacific salmon, and every summer and fall, millions of wild salmon fill the more than 4,000 spawning streams in the Tongas. This is the time of year when this whole place comes alive. Where there's a concentration of food, the crowds show up, not unlike a Friday night all-you-can-eat buffet. And the great numbers of salmon here help to explain why the Tongas region supports the world's highest nesting density of bald eagles, and why there are 80 bears here for every one bear found inland far from salmon streams. I've also been told by bear biologists that more female bears have three cubs versus two or one than anywhere else in the world. And to watch this feeding frenzy has got to be one of the greatest spectacles on our planet. More than 50 species have been documented feeding on salmon, among them black bears, brown bears, gulls, river otters, bald eagles, mink, seals, sea lions, orcas, and people. I know, I eagerly await the salmon's return. Even more astounding, though, to me, is that enough salmon dodge this deadly obstacle course of the beaks and jaws of animals, as well as the nets and hooks of people, to sustain their populations year after year, and they've been doing this for thousands and thousands of years. Now, during salmon time, the competition for food can be fierce. It's every bird, beast, and fisherman for himself. And while the larger animals usually have first dibs on salmon, there are other ways to get a meal. So the eagle here in the center, he has a salmon carcass in his talon, and the eagle on the left is maybe perhaps thinking about stealing it. So while these two are going to have a little squabble, keep an eye on Raven there on the right. So it's very typical eagle behavior. He's standing on his food. He's guarding it. He's vocalizing. He's pretty much shrieking to the guy on the left, stay away from me or I will beat you up. And the guy on the left, he's being submissive. He's got his head down, but he's still eyeing that salmon, isn't he? So while these guys are kind of going at it here, what do you think Raven's going to do? Yeah, it does not take long of watching ravens and particularly hearing them vocalize to understand why the native people of the region refer to Raven as the trickster. So while there's a lot of action going on at the mouths of these salmon streams and in the estuaries, I noticed that many salmon make it past this gateway between ocean and land, and they keep swimming upstream into the forest. So this is kind of the perfect route that salmon take, or this illustrates it. So the ocean's out here, and they've left the ocean. They've entered this intertidal estuary area, and then they found the main channel of the stream. This whole black swarm here, that's all salmon. And this is not an unusual sight in the more than 4,000 spawning streams in this area at a certain time of year. It's absolutely astounding. So, again, they found the main channel of the stream, and they keep going. They don't just stop there. They keep going into the forest. And so I decide to follow them and find out where they go. And for this, I head to Wrangell Island, where I meet up with a woman named Brenda Schwartz-Jaeger. Brenda's a fourth-generation Alaskan whose ancestors worked as bounty hunters, trappers, and big game guides. And Brenda tells me that she's the first generation in her family to be able to bring people to the Tongass and not take anything other than photographs. She says that in society today, we're used to pushing a button and controlling our scenery or the temperature or the sound. But in a real wilderness, she says, we quickly realize that we're not in control, and it's humbling. And she thinks it's good for us to be humbled. Probably no other place Brenda goes allows people to experience wild Alaska better than a place called Annan Creek. So off we go, headed for the mainland, zooming over the water in her boat, which she has named the Wild Side. So we moor the boat at the mouth of the creek, and we enter the forest on foot. It's mid-August, and the place is thrumming with life as gobs of salmon make their way upstream. The harpy screams of ravens emanate from the forest. Bald eagles swoop from treetop to rocktop, eyeballing the feast before them. Hordes of Bonaparte gulls descend upon the stream, scooping up salmon eggs. About a mile into the forest, the stream is pinched by a series of waterfalls, and it is here where the salmon are jammed up. And it is here where the big boys gather for this all-you-can-eat buffet. Now, black bears are the star attraction here, but since Annan Creek is on the mainland and not one of the islands, brown bears occasionally show up too. And when they do, the black bears give them plenty of space. Now, the bears are very wary of one another. Bears are not social animals. They don't hang out in packs or herds or anything like that. But when the food supply is this plentiful, they will somewhat tolerate each other's presence. But there's definitely a hierarchy. You can just feel the tension and the stress that's going on a salmon stream where there's a lot of bears. And in general, the bigger the bear, the better the fishing spot. And I have to say that these are some of the healthiest bears I have ever seen. The place is literally crawling with bears. And there's so much going on that I don't know where to point my camera. This is a wildlife photographer's dream. Very rarely do you get a place like this where you're just where you know that for every one thing that you're photographing, you're probably missing 100 other things going on right around you. Again, it's a dream, but it can be kind of maddening too. So I try to focus on the bears fishing when another bear jumps onto the viewing platform. This interrupts my concentration just a little bit and forces me to move back. Still another bear passes just a few feet behind me. And yet another bear hangs above me. So in a place like this, you'd better be looking in front of you, behind you, and above you. And, you know, after a couple hours of this, I started scratching my head and going, you know, who's watching whom? Am I watching the bears or are they watching me? And I think it was a little bit of both. So after a couple hours photographing bears, I'm feeling like I've got some good photos of bears. And what I really need now are good photographs of salmon. And even though you have a million salmon right in front of you in a stream, it's really tough to photograph them and have it kind of translate into something. So at this point, I'm trying to ignore the bears and focus on the salmon. So fin to fin, tail to tail, they sway against this current like one giant mob. And I forget that they're individual fish until one springs from the crowd, hurling itself against this foaming wall of water. And then another, and another. And this goes on for hours, days, weeks. But for the salmon, every minute is precious as their time is coming to an end. They've stopped eating. They're in their final act, spawning, and they won't stop pushing upstream until they die. It's a testament to the power of their biological clock. Passing on their genes is their mission in life, and once accomplished, they pay for it with their lives. After spawning, they die. That's the life cycle of the Pacific salmon. So I always like to say that if you're a salmon, there's no such thing as safe sex. You spawn, you die. So stinking, rotten salmon carcasses are now everywhere, and the stench is almost unbearable. I'm surrounded by death, but in death, there is life. And as I contemplate the life cycle of these incredible fish, a bear zooms up a tree with a salmon in its mouth. Could this be salmon in the trees? Technically, this is salmon up a tree. So how the heck do salmon get in the trees? Well, away from the creek, I spot a fresh salmon with a bite taken out of it, dragged and dropped in the forest. Suddenly, the thing I'd been searching for was staring me in the face, and it all made perfect sense. The salmon, bears, trees, soil, bugs, roots, berries, birds, and the bees, it was all right here in this glorious cycle of life, one of the greatest shows on Earth, and one that plays out all over the Tongass every year. So here's the deal. Scientists have found high concentrations of a nitrogen variant in trees near salmon streams. This variant, it's called nitrogen 15, and it comes from the ocean. So how did it find its way from the sea into the forest? Well, it swam there, in the bodies of salmon loaded with marine nutrients from their time at sea. But how exactly does it get into the trees? Well, bears have a lot to do with this. Remember, bears don't really like being around other bears. And so when they catch a fish, they will often carry it away from the stream and into the woods. It turns out that bears can move a lot of salmon into the forest. Researchers say that one bear can carry 40 fish from a stream in 8 hours. So think about the millions of salmon that are in this part of the world, some of the highest densities of black and brown bears in the world. You do the math. That adds up to be a lot of salmon dragged and dropped into the forest. And toward the end of a good salmon season, the bears can afford to be picky. And at this point, they're usually just targeting the richest parts of the fish, and they leave the rest behind. And this certainly doesn't go to waste. Other animals scavenge on these carcasses, and this spreads the nutrients farther throughout the forest. Well, guess what happens? All of this rich fish fertilizer decomposes into the soil, and the trees and other vegetation absorb it through their roots. And scientists have actually been able to trace nitrogen 15 in trees near salmon streams that they can link back to the fish. So that is how salmon end up in the trees. Now, not to be outdone, the trees return the favor by nurturing the salmon. Trees shade the spawning streams. This keeps water temperatures cool for their developing eggs. The roots help stabilize the stream banks. This prevents erosion from fouling the clean water and gravel beds that the salmon need to lay their eggs. And fallen trees over the streams create protected pools and provide food for insects that then feed the young fish. So in parts of the Tongass, trees help grow salmon, and salmon help grow trees. Salmon are part ocean, and they're part forest. When you understand this connection, this remarkable connection between salmon and trees, you quickly start to see other connections. Bald eagles, fueled by salmon, will soar greater distances to find food during the lean winter months. Female bears, padded with fat reserves, will give birth in their dens and nurse their tiny cubs with salmon-enriched milk. The forest, fertilized with supercharged soil from decayed fish, will sprout new growth come spring. And what about the salmon? Well, as winter arrives, the last of the adult fish are spawned out, and their nutrient-packed bodies pick clean. But they didn't die in vain. Swaddled in the streams and incubated by the forest, their fertilized eggs will soon hatch the next generation, ensuring that this cycle of life is a circle, always flowing, never broken. So I always like to say in the Tongass, what goes around comes around. And that goes for us, too. Salmon help us understand that we also need healthy forests and oceans for the gifts of clean water, air, and food. And what we do to the forests can affect the oceans, and what we do to the oceans can affect the forests. So what's the threat to the Tongass? Well, it's helpful to know a little history. When Russians and Europeans arrived on these forested shores in the 1700s, they saw a land of superabundance, and they started taking things. They started taking things in great quantities, things like gold, sea otter furs, whale oil, and salmon as well. Now, we were a little slow to start taking timber here in great quantities, but that all changed after World War II. Industrial-scale logging began in earnest here, and some of the great forests of the Tongass began to fall. Thousands of miles of logging roads and clear cuts have degraded parts of the Tongass, impacting some salmon streams and the people and wildlife who rely on them. Now, keep in mind that as big as the Tongass is, 17 million acres, 40% is not forested at all. It's rock, ice, wetlands, and freshwater. Only 30% of the Tongass contains what are called productive old-growth forests with commercial timber value, and less than 3% of the entire Tongass contains what are called large tree productive old-growth forests. These are among the areas most valuable to wildlife, including salmon and the people who rely on them. And while these forests are best known for their centuries-old giants, they are, in fact, what are called multi-aged or ageless forests. And I'll explain what I mean by this. So when a giant falls, like this one did here, snapped off on its own, this creates a gap in the canopy, and this allows light to reach the forest floor and stimulate new growth. So saplings and shrubs then sprout and clamor for the sky. All ages and sizes of trees over many centuries create a multi-storied canopy. And in a forest like this, in death, there is life. A fallen tree here becomes a nurse log, and its decay provides nutrients for new trees. Many decades later, we can see where that nurse log once was. Now referred to as a ghost log that nourished this tree that started its life on top of it. A standing dead snag here does not go to waste. It provides homes and lookout spots for all kinds of critters. And the feast that the forest provides nourishes many different animals. This is a plant called Devil's Club, and it's large clumps of berries, it turns out, very critical food source for bears. And Devil's Club is also one of the most important medicinal and ceremonial plants for the native people. Bunchberry, this is a critical food source for the Sitka black-tailed deer, particularly in the winter months. And the deer, in turn, is an important food source for wolves, bears, and many of the local people here rely on the deer for subsistence. So what happens after all the trees are removed from one of these forests? Well, there is a lot of new growth at first. Again, light is now hitting the forest floor, and this is stimulating growth. But this doesn't last very long. In a relatively short amount of time, just a few decades or so, the even-aged trees that grow up, they create a closed canopy, and this shades out any kind of understory plants. This particular forest was clear-cut about 60 years ago, and today, biologically, it's a desert. There's absolutely no understory, no plants, no food for wildlife. This is particularly hard on the deer in the winter months. And there are many parts of the Tongass that now look like this. And scientists have determined that the forest will persist in this state for several centuries before it begins to develop those complex, multi-layered structural characteristics of a productive old-growth forest again. So while trees are renewable, an old-growth forest in this part of the world is not, not on any kind of human time frame. So of North America's original coastal temperate rainforest, which once extended intact all the way from south central Alaska down into southeast Alaska, British Columbia, Washington, Oregon, and Northern California. And the different shades of green here just represent different climate zones. And within each climate zone, you'll find a different mix of animals and plants. But at one time, that was all one contiguous forest. So of this, 44% has been affected by things like urban development, logging, or farming. And most of this has taken place from Vancouver Island in British Columbia south. So all the areas that you see in red here have been developed in some way, and those original forests are now gone. And in some parts, they're long gone. The mighty redwood forests here of Northern California, these were heavily logged by the late 1800s during the Gold Rush era. And the once great forests of Washington and Oregon, where I live, these were logged heavily in the early 1900s for spruce, cedar, and Douglas fir to build airplanes and ships during World War I. Now, with the passing of more than a century, who among us today has a memory of what these forests once contained? Now, I always have to be careful when I give this presentation in the red areas, and Northern California would qualify as one of those, because I don't want you to think that it's all lost, it's all gone, there's no hope. But, you know, what you see today in the redwoods, those are just fragments, just little patches of what once was. But there are many great organizations and good people working very hard to restore salmon in these red areas and to repair damage that has been done to the forest. And I strongly believe that we can and we should do everything we can to restore salmon and a way of life that allowed for people as well as other wildlife. But as these organizations that are working so hard to do this will tell you, it's very difficult to bring something back once it's gone. It's difficult financially, politically. It's a really tough sell to try and convince people to spend a lot of money to restore something that they didn't even know was missing. So it's tough. But again, I still think that we can do this. But here's the good news, and it's the whole reason that I pursued telling the story of this incredible place, and it's why I'm very honored to be working with organizations like Earth Justice that are working so hard to conserve the Tongass. So the Tongass is up there, and remarkably, enough critical areas are still intact, and they're holding the ecological integrity of this whole place together. All of the species that existed at the time of European settlement are still here. That is astounding in the 21st century and when we've lost so much elsewhere. Brown bears wiped out in most of the lower 48 states live here in some of the highest densities in the world, in part due to all of those healthy wild salmon runs, which in turn support other species, as well as a viable fishing industry that's been certified by the Marine Stewardship Council as one of the world's best examples of a sustainable fishery. Humpback whales can still find enough to eat to fuel their long migrations. The native people still live where their ancestors have since time immemorial. All the local people here enjoy a very special way of life. And visitors come here because there is no other place like it on the planet. And the beauty of the Tongass is that it's relatively accessible. A lot of times a real wild area like this, it's hard to get to, it's remote, it's expensive to get to, there's no infrastructure. If you can get there at all, you'll be sleeping on the ground, and that's not always appealing to many people. The Tongass is very unique in this aspect. It's very accessible. Several of the communities, you can fly Alaska Airlines directly into them. You can go here, you can have an incredible wilderness experience if you want, where you won't see another person. You can sleep on the ground to your heart's content. Or you can go here, watch grizzly bears fish for salmon, and that same night be back in a pretty comfortable hotel room. Again, it's very unique. You really can't do that in many parts of the world. I always like to tell people, you know, you can be sitting in Juneau, which is the capital of Alaska, you know, sipping your fancy latte and checking your email on Wi-Fi, and 10 minutes by float plane, you're on Admiralty Island, you know, with the highest density of brown bears in the world. You just don't. There aren't many places where you can do that, where there's that kind of contrast there. So visitors come here, and they come from all over the world. And they come here for many different reasons. They come to walk in the rainforest, to see bears. For many folks, that's the first time. To explore the unique cave features that exist on many of the islands. People definitely come here to fish. And as we like to say in Alaska, you don't fish, you catch. People come to eat the best salmon in the world. To see glaciers, and if you're adventurous, maybe even walk on one. People come to scuba dive, believe it or not. Very cold, but incredible life forms underneath that water. People come here to canoe, to kayak, to learn about the native cultures, both past and present, and to be out on the ocean, watching for humpback whales, and if you're lucky, maybe even see one breach. Well, people come here for many different reasons. I think that they all leave with Alaska in their hearts. And personally, that's a really good thing to have in your heart. And while I came here looking for salmon and trees, I also found wonderful communities of people everywhere I went. There aren't many places in our country where you can find fishing towns anymore, or a state capital accessible only by boat or airplane, or a boardwalk town with absolutely no roads or cars, or towns whose histories are not forgotten, with cultures that have endured for millennia. So I met people whose lives ebb and flow with the rhythms of this place. And what I love most about the way of life here, and it's what I miss when I come back to the lower 48, is that people here don't live by the clock. They live by the seasons. And their seasons are defined by very delicious things like salmon, berries, and deer. So whenever I come to Southeast Alaska, kind of a strange way, I always feel like I'm coming home. This is how we're supposed to live. In tune with the gifts that nature provides for us, and connected to the very things that nourish both our bodies and our spirits. Now, some of the most biologically critical areas of the Tongass, those places holding the ecological integrity of this whole place together, they're not protected. And threats to them include things like continued logging, mining, industrial scale tourism, energy development, global climate change, and who knows what else down the road. Things we're probably not even thinking about today. Yet despite these threats, I have hope. I have a lot of hope for this place. I think that we can get it right in the Tongass simply because there's still time to do so, and today we know it's the right thing to do. And we have an unprecedented opportunity to ensure that the most biologically rich areas actually stay that way. So let us learn from the lessons that salmon in the trees teach us. That everything is connected, that this most magnificent rainforest thrives because all of its pieces still exist, and that we are a part of it all, too. Now, globally, coastal temperate rainforests are rare, covering just 1/1000th of the Earth's land surface. So the areas you see in green here on the map, these are virtually the only places on the entire planet where this type of ecosystem has ever existed. And they're very rare because it takes just the right conditions for them to form. The Tongass, though, again, up there, contains a third of the world's old-growth temperate rainforest and the largest reserves of old-growth forest left in our country. And it's ranked among the top 10 national forests in the United States for its ability to store carbon and regulate global climate. So it's not just important to the people who live here, it's important to all of us. So as you can see, we've been given a great gift. And with that comes a responsibility. The Tongass is public land. It's entrusted to all of us. We all have a say, whether we live in Alaska, California, Illinois, or Florida. belongs to all of us. And it is my greatest hope that the decisions that we make today will ensure that the Tongass will always be a place where there are salmon in the trees. Thank you.
Hi. You've been listening to a program of the Commonwealth Club of California. Our speaker has been Amy Gulick, a conservation photographer and author of the new book, Salmon in the Trees. And now we have time for some audience questions. We don't have a lot of time, but who's got the first question?
Of the pictures you've been showing us, what were the times of years? What were the seasons or months when you were there?
That's a great question. Primarily, I was trying to document that whole life cycle that happens when the salmon are coming in. And it kind of depends on where you are in the Tongass and what stream you're on as to that time of year. And, of course, you can't time it perfectly because it's nature. but in general, the salmon are usually entering their streams kind of mid-July through August. Kind of depends on the species, too, into September as well. For the coho and other species. The driest times of year, for any of you who may be interested in visiting, are May and June. And dry is a relative term. So, I mean, always be prepared for rain up there. And Southeast Alaskans always like to say that after 4th of July, their summer's over. And that's kind of true. So as our summer progresses and usually gets nicer, theirs actually deteriorates. It usually just gets rainier and wetter. So...
You used the term industrial scale tourism, and I was wondering what form does that take and what's the impact that it has?
Industrial scale tourism, and again, I don't want to knock the cruise ship industry because there are many people in Southeast Alaska who now make their living from the cruise ship industry. But if it's not done right, it could definitely harm the area. If you're disgorging 2,000, 3,000 people per boat, and now you've got five boats of that size in port at the same time, that has the potential to do a lot of damage. Fortunately, most of those people just stay in town, and they just kind of hit the T-shirt shops and things like that, which is sad, though, in a way, because they're not really seeing the Tongass either. So far, it's being done, I think, pretty well up there. And people who do go out fishing or go in the rainforest, they go in smaller groups, and it's kind of controlled as to where they go. So, but again, it just always has the potential, I think, to do some damage. You know, we can always love places to death too much.
I have a question. So you said that the whole area is not protected. I'm wondering who owns large swaths of it or large swaths of it, and what can we do to ensure that those areas are protected? And thank you so much for the work that you do with ILCP to promote these kind of activities.
Yeah, and that's a great question. There are many parts of the Tongass that are protected. I didn't want to mislead you. Those real critical biologically productive areas, though, many of those are not. And those are the ones, if we lose those, that whole place is going to unravel. But again, there are places that are protected. There's, I think, 17 different wilderness areas within the Tongass itself. But usually those wilderness areas are in the unproductive areas. We're really good at protecting things like ice and rock. But we're not very good at protecting those really productive, you know, old growth forests, which you can see why. I mean, you know, the timber industry wanted to get in there, or there are places where the mining industry wants to go. And historically, you know, our national forests were managed for resource harvest, whether they're supposed to be or not. That's how they have historically been managed. So what can you do? The Tongass National Forest is public land. It's federal land. Belongs to all of us. Any kind of lasting permanent protection decisions that will be made probably by the United States Congress. So definitely contact your two senators and your representative and let them know how you feel about this place. There's a lot of real positive things going on right now within the Tongass. Earth Justice was the lead. Where's Bill? So, I don't know if you want to talk about that or I can talk about it. There's some very good news that happened last month that concerns the Tongass. And without getting overly... the politics and the legislation that goes on in this forest can get complicated very quickly. But in 2001, there was a what was called the Roadless Area Rule, and that was passed, and it was supposed to apply to 60 million acres within many of our national forests across the country. And they were inventorying these roadless areas and said, okay, no roads will be built in these areas, which in effect meant probably no resource harvest would happen as well. And then shortly after 2001, that roadless rule was, there was an attempt to repeal the entire thing. It was not successful, but they were successful in exempting the Tongass from the roadless rule. And so here we are 10 years later, and that roadless rule has just been reinstated for the Tongass, which is, again, that's really, really good news. But it's not permanent, so there's still a lot we need to be doing. There are many conservation groups that are working on passing some kind of legislation that will protect those biologically critical areas. The legislation has not been introduced yet, but when it is, hopefully you'll pay attention to it, and then that's really the time to contact your senators and your representative. So I hope that answered your question.
Is there a... evidence that climate change has begun to affect the Tongass, and if climate change continues to occur due to pollution, how would that affect the Tongass?
Well, that's a great question. There are some studies that are being done where they're seeing a certain type of tree, the yellow cedar, is dying at certain elevations, and the thinking right now by the scientists working on that is that that is climate related, that there's at certain elevations there's not enough snow that is covering the roots and insulating them in the winter, and so they're seeing a die-off there. So that's one way that they think climate change may be affecting this forest. The other one is salmon definitely could easily be affected by climate change, because salmon are so sensitive to water temperature. And so if that water temperature is either too warm or there's not enough water that comes into their stream right when they need to be spawning, salmon are going to have a really tough time.
All right, you've been listening to a program of the Commonwealth Club of California. Our speaker is Amy Gulick, author of the recent book Salmon in the Trees. I would like to acknowledge the important role that Earth Justice played in organizing this, in particular Bill Karpowitz. And please join me in thanking our speaker, Amy Gulick.